Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. A recent government report concluded that this year will be the best year for job growth in the auto industry in more than a decade. Ford has recently reported profits of $4.7 billion. GM and Chrysler are also reporting good economic news. But U.S. automakers aren't on easy street just yet. Foreign competition remains fierce, and the recovery is weak. Joining me to discuss the state of the auto industry, joining us from the studios of WBEZ at Chicago Public Radio, is Micheline Maynard of Public Radio's Changing Gears. Thanks for joining us, Mickey.
Thank you, Susan.
And from Traverse City, Michigan, we're joined by David Shepherdson of the Detroit News. Welcome, David.
Thanks, Susan.
And we'll be joined shortly in the studio by Warren Brown of the Washington Post. We invite you to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Earlier this morning, I spoke with Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm about the changes she's seen in the car industry over the past year. Governor Granholm, thanks for being with us.
You bet.
Your state has lost more than 800,000 jobs in the last decade. Do you see signs now that things are finally turning around?
Yeah, you can't claim victory too quickly, of course, but we have definitely hit bottom and we're starting to climb out, Susan, and much of that is due to two things. One is the president's commitment to the auto industry and certainly to the clean technology that will fuel the pump the electric vehicles, if you will, the battery technology. And the second is that we've really focused in Michigan on adding new sectors to our economy, because up to now, we've been seven times more dependent on the auto industry than other states. So clearly, we've needed to diversify.
Now, in your view, what would have happened in the last few years if the government hadn't stepped in the way it did?
No, we would have lost this manufacturing backbone of the United States. I mean, if you think about this, Susan, the auto industry right now, we've saved about $1 million. I say we, meaning the president, in his effort to save the auto industry. And so this is the first time that the three of them are making a profit, the first time, at least in the past couple of years anyway, the first time since the year 2000 that we've actually added jobs, 55,000 jobs. But if you think about this industry as sort of a, the hub of the wheel for manufacturing nationally, we would have seen devastation across the country, not just in the manufacturing sector, but this car is the most technologically advanced mass-produced product in the world, and it has about 10,000 parts in it, and each of those parts is attached to some suppliers. So all kinds of industries would have been affected, the steel industry, the glass industry, electronics, rubber, technology, lighting, and then the folks who serve the industry, like the trucking industry, the rail industry, IT, advertising, financial, car loans, when you think about that. So it's really this backbone for making things in America, and what this has done is essentially save that. Without it, I'm just telling you, we would have lost several hundred more thousand jobs in Michigan alone, 1 million jobs nationwide, just directly related to the auto industry. So this is a huge deal, not just for Michigan, not just for the Midwest, but really for the nation to have that manufacturing backbone, frankly, for our energy security in the future, because we have to make the stuff to get us off of our reliance on foreign oil, and the car is the way to do that, one of the ways to do that, and for our national security as well.
And yet this auto bailout, now a year old, remains pretty unpopular in polling across the country. And some Americans are uncomfortable, I think, with the kind of expanded government role they saw the federal government take with that. What do you say to them?
I mean, really, think about this. Other countries, we're not just competing state to state. We're competing country to country, or sometimes state to country. Other countries are stepping in to ensure that they have a manufacturing infrastructure because those countries see it as important for their national security. In other words, if you've got to manufacture tanks or planes and you have lost your manufacturing capacity, then you're essentially going to be outsourcing that to countries that may not be in your best interest. interest. So other nations are stepping in. For example, Korea just 2 weeks ago announced that it was going to invest $20 billion, with a B, in their battery industry for their electric vehicles. They decided it's a strategic national interest. What we need to do in America is have the same thing. And a lot of people just don't realize, I think, that unless they're working in the auto industry, that this is critical to our nation's security. And obviously, now that the auto industry is back on track, or at least is on the right, headed in the right direction, and the federal government is going to get paid back, this really was a no-brainer in retrospect.
You said that just said the federal government's going to get paid back. Do you think federal taxpayers will get all the money back that they invested in the auto industry?
It certainly looks like it's heading that way. I know the president said that, and obviously General Motors has to go public so that it can pay back the taxpayers. But you know what, Susan? That to me, that question is really a question that's on a broader perspective of how active should governments be in making sure that jobs remain in their countries. And I think the government has to be active. Not that the government can create jobs, but the government can strategically invest where it may be at this point too risky for a market in a global economy. For example, in the technologies related to clean energy, individual business can't invest in the electric grid, but the government can, and the government needs to in order to create that industry. So there is a role for government, just like there's a role for the private sector.
And just one last question. Looking ahead, this new U.S. auto industry, in the wake of all the troubles that they've had, how is it going to be different from the old U.S. auto industry?
The old U.S. auto industry was top-heavy, bureaucratic, and was not lean and mean. And now we've got an industry that's lean, mean, and green. And instead of being viewed as Luddites or as resisting corporate average fuel economy standards, this auto industry is going to lead the nation to energy independence with new management, new labor agreements, a UAW that is obsessed with quality, quality rankings that are at the top. This is going to be a different world, and it should be. So I have very positive outlook on the future for the U.S. auto industry.
Governor Granholm, thanks so much for being with us.
You bet. Thanks, Susan.
That was my interview this morning with the Michigan Governor, Jennifer Granholm. Well, Mickey Maynard, do you think that, in fact, GM, Ford, and Chrysler are now safely back from the brink?
Well, they're safely back from looking down the abyss, but what they have to do is climb back to being consistently profitable and to building cars and SUVs and minivans that people actually want to own. You know, one thing to remember is that General Motors and Chrysler, which are the two companies that filed for bankruptcy with the government's help, are about 30% of the auto industry. The rest of the industry is Ford plus all those foreign automakers who have built plants everywhere from Columbus, Ohio, down to Texas and over to South Carolina. So this wouldn't have been the entire American auto industry had something really severe happen to General Motors and Chrysler. And what they have to do, what Ford has to do, what everybody has to do, is compete in what is now a wide open playing field and compete for the dollars of Americans who are right now a little skittish about spending money on cars because they're worried about employment, they're worried about housing, and there's some consumer confidence issues.
Well, David Shepardson, how big a role did the government bailout play in moving back from the abyss, as Mickey Maynard just said?
Oh, it was huge. I mean, without first the intervention of President Bush in December 2008 and the $17 billion to rescue GM and Chrysler and the subsequent, you know, about $65 billion that the Obama administration infused into the industry, there would not be a GM and Chrysler. I mean, those companies would have liquidated in short order. But I think the real argument is going to be, with Republicans, is was this the right way to rescue these two companies? Remember, a lot of people had to make big sacrifices. Thousands of dealers were slated for closing. Stockholders and bondholders took, you know, either wiped out or lost nearly all of their stake. And, you know, the real question is going to be, at the end of the day, was this the way that was the right way to go?
And what would have been the alternative?
Well, I think in December 2008, there was really no alternative because both of these companies had made really no preparations for any sort of bankruptcy, and there was really no chance that the companies would have gotten financing from the private sector to restructure. And I think even in March of 2009, when the president made the decision to grant the companies additional money and time to restructure, it was also unlikely that GM would have gotten $30 billion in financing to restructure, given that that was the largest ever bankruptcy financing in history. So I think realistically, for the companies to exist in sort of the way they are today, the government was the only actor that was going to step in with that kind of money to save those two companies.
Warren Brown of the Washington Post, do you agree? What's your perspective 1 year after?
My perspective 1 year after is that a lot of what is being said is basically wrong. The bottom line is that if you looked at the industry very closely, for example, if you looked at Ford, Ford had the good fortune of failing, almost failing, 2 years, 3 years before GM and Chrysler. If you go back and you look at the history, Ford was in very bad shape. They were near bankruptcy. But Ford did what GM and Chrysler didn't do, certainly what GM didn't do. And that is, Ford just basically said, you know, we're going to change. We're going to stop this. They got rid of the family folk who were running a company. They brought in this guy, Alan Mulally, and he made a lot of tough decisions. He got rid of things like Jaguar and Land Rover and Aston Martin, all of these things that weren't really contributing to Ford's bottom line. GM's problem wasn't, you know, product, and it really wasn't, you know, management and all the rest of the things that people keep talking about. If you look at GM over the past 5-6 years, they have steadily been improving product, steadily been improving product quality. GM's problem was that it thought it had time that the recession didn't allow.
Warren Brown, he's automotive writer and On Wheels columnist for the Washington Post. And we're also joined this hour by Mickey Maynard. She's senior editor of Changing Gears, a new public radio project. And David Shepherdson, who joins us from Traverse City, Michigan. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Detroit News. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk with an auto analyst, and we'll take your calls and questions, 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And as we discuss the future of the auto industry, we're going to talk for just a few minutes from the offices of Moody's, Inc. in Westchester, Pennsylvania, Sophia Korepetsky. She's a managing director who covers labor markets, auto-related industries, and the Midwestern economy. Thanks for being with us, Sophia.
Good morning.
Last year, you helped prepare a report on what a government bailout of GM and Chrysler could mean. What did you foresee at that point?
We believed a year ago, and I thought that we were pretty prescient, that with the economy was in a deep recession, and we expected that there would be nationwide an additional 4.8 million jobs that were going to be lost. And I ran a number of scenarios, assuming that what if Chrysler was allowed to fail, what if Chrysler and GM were allowed to fail, then what if all three failed. And given the fact that auto sales were in a tailspin, given the fact that the economy was in a very deep recession, I determined that if all three failed, that the economy would lose an additional 800,000 jobs. And what that would do is that would prolong the recession, that would have a devastating effect just on confidence nationwide, and that in the circumstances, a bailout was a wise move. If these companies had failed in a better economic climate, then the economy would be able to withstand it. But how, because the economy was in such poor shape, allowing these companies to fail would have had a very deleterious effect on the overall economy.
Now, that would have been if all three of them had failed.
Yes.
What about, do you think, with the benefit of hindsight, which is, of course, more often 2020 than foresight, with the benefit of hindsight, do you think these companies could have muddled through without the kind of government role that they had?
I don't think so. I don't think they could have managed. They were bleeding cash, and they were not selling cars, and their management system was too ossified to adjust quickly enough. Of course, the 2008 UAW contract did allow for large savings in for their legacy costs, their labor costs, which was continuing, and they already had a variety of restructuring plans that they were seeing through. But because that additional element of the poor economy, that they would have not been able to survive.
So in your view, this was the right thing for the government to do?
Yes, it was.
Yeah. Well, Sophia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Sophia Korapetsky, she's a managing director at Moody's, Inc., and joined us from their offices in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Mickey, tell us about the importance. We heard President Obama, when he headed to Michigan last week, talking about the importance of these new technologies and the Chevy Volt, for instance. How important is this new car to U.S. auto manufacturers?
I think what we're seeing now is the emergence of a sort of an alternative fuel market. It's still very small, and it's still dominated by vehicles like the Toyota Prius and some of the other hybrids at Ford, and General Motors has a few of them. What the Volt is sort of like the moonshot for General Motors. It's an effort for the company to show that they do understand that alternative fuel vehicles, plug-in hybrids, electric cars are going to be a part of the market of the future. And in the past, it's sort of been science experiments, but I think now they're taking their place in the showroom.
Now, Warren Brown, your newspaper, The Washington Post, ran an op-ed piece yesterday that argued that electric cars are just too expensive for most drivers. Did you agree?
No. In terms of being expensive now, yeah, but it all depends which electric cars you're talking about. You know, the Nissan Leaf is not going to be prohibitively expensive. And it all depends on what kind of electric car you want. If you want essentially a neighborhood electric car, you know, something like the Wego or, you know, that sort of thing, you know, it works perfectly fine for early adopters and people like that who want that sort of thing. But let's keep in mind, people keep talking about the Chevrolet Volt. The Chevrolet Volt is not at all the most important car for General Motors. The most important car for General Motors right now would be the Chevrolet Cruze, which is, you know, affordable and is fuel efficient and is a high quality small car. If GM can sell lots of those, GM is in good shape. A second most important car for GM would be the Buick Regal, which GM dumbly advertises as a German, German-made, car, which, you know, odd thing to do when you just borrowed $50 billion from your fellow Americans. But the Buick Regal is an excellent car. These are the cars that are the most important for GM alone. And I would also take issue with my dear friend Mickey Mannert. GM hasn't been tinkering around and playing around, you know, with the whole notion of alternatively fueled cars. They've been doing that earnestly and spending billions of dollars in the process of doing that. GM's problem was public relations, which it very seldom, if ever, gets right. And the public relations problem was this. GM thought that Americans were patient enough, you know, intelligent enough to go along with the idea of something as, you know, exotic as hydrogen-fueled cars. Possible, desirable for a whole bunch of reasons, yes. But, you know, my late father was a research scientist for the National Science Foundation. And if there's one thing I found, you know, living with a scientist, is that science takes time. And science does not favor people who have short attention spans and who want it right now. Hydrogen was not going to be something that was going to be right now, but GM was acting as if they could make it, you know, right now. Public didn't go along with that. And so GM finally, like BMW and all of the German automakers did the same, finally came around to the idea that, yeah, we better try to kind of go with gas electric, you know, right now, because that's what people understand.
So, Mickey, what do you think?
Well, I remember Warren's father, who is just a lovely man, and I had the pleasure of meeting him in New Orleans a few years ago, so I'm glad to hear you speak about him. But I do think that General Motors and Ford and Chrysler did miss an opportunity to jump into the mass market of these hybrid electric vehicles and electric vehicles sooner. We heard Bill Ford, who ran Ford during the sort of middle part of the last decade, talk about building more hybrids, and yet Ford built about 20,000 hybrid Escape SUVs over the years because they sensed that there wasn't more market demand for them. Now I think we've seen a sea change in the way Americans think about automobiles, and I think this has been forced by the recession, that out in the country where people have public transportation, more people are using public transportation. They've downsized their fleets. The kids who are in school now, like my nephews, have had the opportunity to drive hybrid electric vehicles, and they've all seen the Al Gore movie. And I think there's much more interest in Americans because of the recession and because of environmental consciousness than there might have been 10 years ago. And 10 years ago is when you had to get really serious about this development. I think it's a great thing that we're seeing cars like the Volt and the Nissan Leaf and the others that will come. But as Warren said, science does take time, and that's about how much time you need, about a decade to really get serious about this.
Dave Shepardson, you're the Washington Bureau Chief for the Detroit News, but you're in Traverse City today. Tell us about the meeting you're attending.
Well, this is an annual conference of auto executives, labor leaders, and analysts that meet for 4 days to talk about the state of the industry. You know, and one of the big things they're talking about is looking at the bailout. And I think the important point is it was not just the fact that the government stepped in with $85 billion to rescue the two companies and the two auto finance companies. It was also that GM and Chrysler were able to get rid of tens of billions of dollars in liabilities, along in terms of both health care costs for retirees and money they owed. As a result, these companies are now sized to be profitable, selling far fewer cars a year and have far fewer structural costs, not to mention the fact that the UAW is prohibited from striking through 2015 and agreed to a lot of work rule changes and wage cuts. So as a result, you have a company like Ford, which was able to wipe out $7 billion in debt in the last quarter, but it still owes $27 billion. So, you know, I think the message of this conference is that the industry, sort of the storm has passed. The auto sales are up. 2009 was the worst year in auto sales in 30 years. And the economy is starting to gradually move ahead, and that the industry is not going to fall off the cliff as it looked like it might just a year ago.
Well, let's go to some of our listeners. Susie is calling us from Hillsdale, Michigan, the state that we've been talking about. Susie, hi. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I think one thing that has always been ignored in this conversation about, especially what Mickey says, that GM and Ford and Chrysler did not make vehicles that Americans wanted, I think is off base unless you're in a metro area. Metro area are basically cars only. I live in a rural area, and full-size trucks are extremely important.
And Susie, what kind of vehicle do you drive?
I have a Tahoe.
A big truck.
Is that a big truck? Yeah.
That's a big truck. Yeah. I also live on a farm.
Well, you know, and Susie, yes, I totally understand your point. I would certainly not argue that you know, people don't want to buy GM, Ford, and Chrysler pickup trucks. If you live in Texas or Montana or a western state or a rural area, you definitely want a pickup, and that's a place where the Detroit carmakers have always led the market. I think the argument that I am looking at was more aimed at sort of suburban and urban areas where you do have access to public transportation. You certainly, it's kind of hard to take a subway in Hillsdale. It wouldn't probably go very far either, but I do understand your point.
All right. Warren?
Well, you know, I was always amused at this assertion that the big three didn't make cars that people wanted, which statistically just doesn't make much sense to me. When GM still has, I think, the majority share, you know, of the market in the United States, which means that somebody must have been buying, you know, GM cars and GM cars and trucks. What? Ford Motor Company, for the past, 30 years, has had the best-selling vehicle in the United States, which is a Ford F-150 truck. So I never really quite understood that colorful, catchy assertion that they weren't doing something that people wanted.
They don't have the majority of the car market anymore, Warren. Right. GM has 20% of the market. And if you put the foreign manufacturers together, they're about 55%.
I understand
the car
that,
market
Nikki.
Specifically. But Warren, the foreign manufacturers took over the car market specifically about 5 years ago. And I don't make the assertion that they didn't build something that people wanted to buy.
Mickey, my point is that GM's 20% share of the market compares with what to Toyota and everybody else.
And Dave,
Ford's
did you have something?
17, and Toyota's at about 16.
Well, then I think 20% trumps those. Thank you.
Dave?
No. I think the point is that the main problem the Detroit Three companies have had for 40 years is that their market share has continued to decline steadily over that period. In fact, as recently as 15 years ago, the Detroit Three companies held nearly 60% of the market share. And as Mickey points out, that's fallen to 45%. And the companies have had a lot of trouble selling vehicles on the West and East Coast. If you look at their market share in California, it's far lower than the rest of the country. I mean, there's no, as Mickey said earlier, in a lot of markets like Michigan, rural areas, the Detroit Three companies still far outsell their foreign competitors. The problem is the market share has declined, and you can't have a business model that, you know, continues to decline and decline. There has to be a bottom, and I think the companies have, you know, realized that, and their aim, remember what GM CEO Ed Whitaker said, one of his first messages was, this company has to increase market share, but it has to do it profitably.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850. Let's take another caller. Raul is calling us from Miami. Raul, thanks for holding on.
Yes, good morning. Great show. My question is, why is the resale value of American cars so much lower than Japanese or German cars?
Okay, well, we'll put that to our panel. Raul, let me ask you, what kind of vehicle do you drive? It sounds like you're in one right now.
Right, I'm in an SUV, Honda CR-V, and I drive also, this is my company car, and I drive a Saturn.
Uh-huh. All right, Raul, thanks for your call. What about Raul's question about the resale value of American cars?
Well, let me take a quick stab at that, because I think there are two factors that are involved in that. I think the studies are showing that Detroit vehicles, by and large, their initial quality when they come out of the factory for the first 90 days is pretty much on par with foreign manufacturers. But over time, over 3 to 5 years, the quality slips, and that's when the problems traditionally have started. The second issue is that the Detroit manufacturers have always sold more vehicles to fleets, to companies, to rental car companies than the Detroit automakers, and so they'll buy these cars in bulk and then turn them on to the used car market. And then when you have a flood of cars like that, that brings down used car prices. Now, I will say that these fleet sales have been cut back, especially as the recession has hit. So you could be seeing the resale value of Detroit automobiles rising over the next few years.
Dave, you were with President Obama on Friday when he visited Michigan, talked about the auto bailout and the results that it's had. What kind of reception did he get?
Oh, it was Very positive. You know, it was really like a campaign-style rally. I had a brief conversation with GM's North American chief, Mark Royce, who really got emotional when I simply asked what was his reaction to the visit. The message that the president was bringing was don't bet on the American worker. The opponents of the auto bailout wanted these companies to fail or would have been willing to let these companies fail. I think it's a pretty, you know, strong message that the administration is going to try to push on the campaign trail over the next few months. You know, the president's going to Chicago on Thursday to visit a Ford factory. And if you look at all the things they've done, the bank rescues, or the financial reforms, and so on, this is probably one of the most easy for people to understand that had he not stepped in, these companies would in all certainty not exist today.
You know, that may be the case in Detroit, but the fact is when we do polling about the auto bailout, a lot of Americans, a majority of Americans say that it was a bad idea. Warren Brown, why is it not more popular than it is?
Well, because hypocrisy is a wonderful thing, isn't it? Most of the people, for example, when you look at the Southern Congress people who were largely against the bailout, including some Democrats from the South. But you go to their states, and their states basically constitute, you know, the new Detroit. Every foreign manufacturer selling vehicles, you know, in the United States, for the most part, has set up shop in the Deep South. So, and that was done with state aid and federal aid. So totally hypocritical to me.
We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll go back for your calls and questions and comments. You can call us 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
Bladder cancer is the fifth most commonly diagnosed cancer in the U.S. and one of the most expensive to treat. Each year, more than 60,000 new cases are discovered, and 14,000 Americans die from the disease. Efforts to spread the word about bladder cancer. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Joining me in the studio, Warren Brown of the Washington Post. With us from Chicago, Micheline Maynard from Changing Gears. And in Traverse City, Michigan, David Shepherdson from the Detroit News. We've been talking about the state of the U.S. auto industry 1 year after that big government bailout. Let's go to Caitlin and talk to her. She's joining us from Alexandria, Virginia. Caitlin, you're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, go ahead.
I just had a quick comment. I'm in the D.C. metro area now, but I was born and raised in the metro Detroit area, and many people in my family work for GM. My grandfather worked at the Proving Grounds in Milford as a manager for 35 years. And I think it's sort of what gets left out of these conversations invariably is that GM has had to, you know, slash retiree benefits, and a lot of people have lost their jobs. And I just feel like, you know, we might have saved the industry momentarily, but it's not really good business to sort of destroy these thousands and thousands of jobs and people and retirees that rely on the benefits. And I think it's really damaged Michigan's economy, which is already hurting quite a bit.
You know, we also have an email from Luke, who writes us from Michigan, making a similar point about current jobs in Michigan. Now in Michigan, he says there are no good paying jobs left for anyone and no pressures for wages to increase. We might have saved some jobs, but we further entrenched the stratification of the class system that's growing in this nation. Well, let me ask our panel, what happened with UAW wages and treatment of retirees in this process over the last year? David?
Well, first, remember that about 200,000 jobs have been cut by the Detroit Three in the last 5 years. For salaried retirees at GM, they've seen dramatic cuts in their retiree health benefits. They did not lose their pension plans. In the case of one of GM's suppliers, Delphi, the company turned its pension plan over to the government and abandoned it. And the other issue is that for union retirees, much of the billions of dollars that they were owed in long-term benefits were converted into stock. So in the example of Chrysler, the UAW Retiree Health Trust owns about 67% of Chrysler, and the only way that those retirees will get sort of long-term benefits is if they're able to sell that stock down the road at a profit. So, you know, and probably the biggest concession is the fact that new UAW workers, like the 900 new jobs that were announced Friday that will go in Sterling Heights, Michigan, at an assembly plant that was to stay open at Chrysler, they're going to get $14 an hour, which translates into about $32,000 a year. And they're not going to enjoy likely the sort of unlimited overtime that once was the hallmark of the industry, where you could, you know, 30 years ago, get out of high school, get a job at the plant in your town, and make enough money to get married, buy a house and a cottage up north. These jobs are still relatively well paying for, as the emailer pointed out, the depressed job market in a lot of Midwestern towns. But it's not what the UAW hourly jobs were in the past, to be sure.
Mickey, what do you think about this?
Yes, Susan, I think one of the things that's going on in Michigan and the rest of sort of this industrial belt is that you're seeing this transition, a very painful one, from an economy where really you could graduate high school or maybe not even graduate high mm-hmm. school. And if you had a friend or family member who worked at one of the car companies or a supplier, they could get you in and you would be making a very good living wage, a white collar type wage. Yeah. And this went on for generations. And one of the things that our Changing Gears project is going to be looking at is how do these states reinvent themselves? One of the most interesting things about Michigan is that in the Metro Detroit area, the largest employer is Ford Motor Company. The second largest employer is the University of Michigan. And up in Flint, there are now more people going to universities than work at General Motors. And one of the things I find fascinating is that there's a government-funded project to clean up the plant sites of former General Motors operations. There's about 90 of them around the country. That could create a couple of thousand jobs in Flint. So sort of taking apart the auto industry might actually create an industry of its own.
But is it just now the reality that those very middle-class jobs that UAW workers could count on, that is just not going to be the case going forward? It's going to be a much more limited in terms of pay and benefits.
Well, it's a much more competitive job market. If you decide to do a manufacturing job and it's a non-union manufacturing job, as Dave said, you're probably going to make $10 to $12 an hour. If you're lucky enough to get hired in and join the UAW, you might make a couple of dollars an hour more. So we're rethinking and we're relooking at what manufacturing jobs are. Now, I will say that at some of the foreign manufacturing plants in the South, Toyota, Honda, some of the others, they're still paying in the 20s. But I would imagine that as the pressure from the UAW to keep wages up goes away, that you will start to see adjustments in wages paid at those plants. And those workers are not union members, and they really can't do a whole lot about it.
Let's go to St. Louis and talk to Mike. He's giving us a call. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. I'm wondering why we have such sympathy for the car companies as legacy companies and the auto workers themselves, although I feel more sorry for them to have lost their... But they've essentially taken us for granted for all these years when foreign competition came in and started to nibble away at them, and they just never changed. And the really mind-boggling thing, I thought, from the executive side was that the executives always told us our cars are just as good as the competition, which is no way to sell a product, to say, well, we're just as good, you know, and you, besides, we're Americans, so you should buy us. And I just never understood that when we were paying so much for the cars through the subsidies and all the other things, that and they weren't as good toward the end.
Mike, let me just ask you, if you don't mind, what kind of vehicle do you drive?
Well, I started driving Toyotas about 20 years ago, mainly because I looked at the product on the floor at an auto show, and I opened the hood, and I saw the Toyota had all the wires neatly fastened with fasteners to keep them away from the engine, where the Ford at the time, although it's much better, it's a good product now, they had the wires wrapped with duct tape dangling around the engine compartment. And I thought, well, this is no good, and I got almost 700,000 miles out of two Toyota trucks. Over about 15 years, and you can't beat that.
Right, Mike, thanks very much for your call. Warren?
You know, you have to understand Walmart if you're going to understand what's happening, you know, to the automobile industry. And unfortunately for the UAW, it has absolutely no understanding of Walmart. It's the biggest non-union retail enterprise around. Extremely strong in places like Ohio and Michigan, which are traditional bulwarks of the UAW and other organized labor. But if you would go into a Walmart in any weekend and just stand there for several hours, which I have actually done, and watch who's coming in and who's going out, no, you'll see a lot of union members coming into Walmart. Now, why are they there? They're there for the same reason that people are in Hyundai stores and Honda stores and everything else. They're looking for the best deal for the least amount of money. Or if they're going to pay more money, you know, they are looking for absolutely great quality. And that's why they are there. And until we understand that, what we as consumers, are doing, to ourselves when we make what I call a Walmart, you know, decision, you know, you won't understand things such as the declining market share of American car companies. The UAW's biggest problem is that it has failed, absolutely miserably failed, you know, to organize any competitor of General Motors, you know, Ford or Chrysler. And as long as that failure persists, the UAW will continue to shrink.
Oh, Susan, can I jump in for one second?
Sure, go ahead, Dave.
I think this caller hits on the point you were making earlier about why is the auto bailout so unpopular. I mean, a lot of consumers in the early 80s or later had a bad experience with an American car, abandoned those companies for any number of reasons. You throw in the fact that 8 million people are unemployed, many people work in jobs that have not gotten bailouts, and this is the reason why this was the most unpopular decision, even the president has said, of his whole administration. So I think, you know, this caller and others, you know, say, hey, I stopped buying American cars. Why do I have to use my tax dollars to bail them out? And it's a hard argument to explain to some consumers.
You know, Mike also talked about his satisfaction with Toyota as a brand. He had had two trucks and gotten some enormous series of miles on them. But I wonder how much Toyota, of course, has had some big troubles with quality more recently. How much has that meant for U.S. automakers?
Well, that's a huge issue for them because, as Dave was saying earlier, you've seen the steadily declining market share. I wrote a book a few years ago called The End of Detroit, and when the book came out in 2003, the Detroit car companies had about 61% or two-thirds of the American car market, and now they have under 50%. So you can see that this market share decline is sort of like the steady raindrops on concrete, and eventually you will erode the concrete. I want to just say one other thing about the UAW situation, because I think President Obama made a choice at the very beginning of his administration that he would save General Motors and Chrysler. It was a political choice. It was a policy choice. And that's why this initial public offering, General Motors selling stock again, is so important because I think the administration would very much like to say, look, we sent them through bankruptcy. They came out of bankruptcy. Now they're available to the public again. We're done. And unless he can do that, I think he will be continuing to face criticism over why did you pick the car companies?
But, Dave, you know, we heard President Obama on Friday say that all the money was going to get repaid. But the White House had to clarify afterwards that they meant all the money that had been paid out during the Obama administration was being repaid, not necessarily, I guess, another $25 billion or so out during the Bush administration. Will taxpayers see their full investment come back?
I would think almost certainly not. Of the $85 billion, they're trying to segregate the $25 billion that President Bush loaned to the companies and the finance companies. I think at the trading values of GM stock, we would lose as a taxpayers anywhere from $12 to $15 billion. Don't forget the fact that the government also infused $17 billion into GM's former finance company, GMAC, now known as Ally Financial. So you're already seeing the administration tout the argument that, hey, even if taxpayers do lose $10 or $15 billion, it's a far better thing than the 1 million jobs or more that could have been lost by just abandoning these companies.
Now, you mentioned, Mickey, that GM is planning to offer an IPO soon. We have an email from Brian who asks, who is going to buy GM stock? Their previous stockholders were sold out in the bankruptcy. How would you answer, Brian? Who's likely to want to invest in GM now?
Well, first of all, one of the things that will happen, I suspect, is that big institutions will be buying General Motors stock. The big banks, who also some of whom were bailed out by the administration, by the Bush administration, may be investing in General Motors. There may be hedge funds that buy General Motors. I was just thinking, though, that when GM sort of stopped trading right before bankruptcy, I think their stock went down to 75 cents. So right. I suppose if it starts at 76 cents, that's kind of a victory for GM. But one of the things with stock, you know, widows and orphans, that was always the joke, was that pension funds, widows and orphans own General Motors stock because it was the safest investment you could make. There are a lot of people will have to be convinced that this is a safe investment before they'll go back in there. And those are probably individual shareholders rather than these big institutions that can afford to gamble their money.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We've been taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Let's go to Centerville, Maryland, and talk to Ed. Ed, hi.
Hi. I want to back up a little bit from just the automobile manufacturers, and I'm glad that the union representative brought up Walmart. Part of the problem here is that we're actually in a situation where there are fewer and fewer people in America who can afford to buy things at certain levels. And I think that the main reason for that is Walmart and NAFTA and other free trade schemes all said that if we open the free trade gates, we'd do a lot better. What's really happening is that more jobs are being lost in the middle class, and there are fewer and fewer people in the middle class to actually buy American goods.
You bring up a big point, Ed, and I wonder about this issue of trade with cars. We have an emailer, Larry from Farmington Hills, Michigan, who asks, can anything be done to persuade Japan and South Korea to allow more U.S. auto imports into their closed markets? How big a problem, Warren Brown, does this continue to be for U.S. manufacturers?
It continues to be a really big problem, but it's something that if the U.S. manufacturers try to drum up sympathy for it, you know, they won't get it. Look, this is what's happening. You know, we complain about losing automobile jobs here, but you can go to Stuttgart, like in Germany. You could go to places in South Korea, and they're not exactly happy because they've lost jobs too. You know, the idea of Hyundai putting up a multi-billion-dollar plant in Alabama doesn't exactly sit well with South Korean citizens. You know, the idea of BMW and Mercedes-Benz putting up plants in the South doesn't sit well with people in those countries. This is a global industry. What's really happening is that the market in the United States is beginning to resemble quite much, you know, the market in Europe, where nobody has more than a 21% share of the market. I mean, this is basically the shape of the world. Look, if you would go, you know, to Western Europe, right? You'll find engineers and designers in Western Europe really not terribly happy about Eastern European engineers and designers beginning to take a lot of those jobs and do them at a lower cost. This is happening globally.
Ed, you raised some important questions in terms of the future of the middle class in America, and that certainly would be a good topic for a future Diane Rehm show. You know, as we leave this hour, I just want to go around our roundtable of auto experts and ask them what they drive. Dave, what do you drive?
Oh, I've got a 2001 Volkswagen Jetta with about 150,000 miles on it, so I'm ready to buy a new car.
That's Dave Shepherdson from the Detroit News. How about you, Mickey Maynard?
I have a 2008 Toyota Prius, and since I've been living in Chicago, I've been getting about 51.8 miles per gallon. So right at the moment, I'm pretty happy with that purchase.
She's senior editor of Changing Gears. And Warren Brown, what is it that you drive?
I have four cars, a Chevrolet HHR. Which is a nice little four-cylinder, runabout carry-all. Mercedes-Benz C230 and Mini Cooper and a Toyota Echo.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's on vacation. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.